Good evening, everybody, and Tony, thank you very much. It's a real privilege for me to be able to address the 850 dinner, particularly in this fantastic location. I think this is one of the best places in the world, really, here, right in this, the end of this peninsula here. So it's a fantastic place to have a dinner. So welcome, particularly to those of you who've come to Australia, and especially those who are here for the first time. The A50 Forum provides a unique opportunity for you to hear directly from the leaders of politics, of business, and Australia's policy institutions. In that way, it's a really unique event. I'm sure you'll find us open and transparent, not just talking about the opportunities that Australia has, but also some of the challenges that are facing us. One of the facts that visitors to Australia most frequently remark upon is the fact that we've experienced 26 years of uninterrupted growth. Over those 26 years, we've certainly had our ups and downs, and we've had periods of rising unemployment, but this long record of economic expansion and stability is not matched elsewhere in amongst the advanced economies. Importantly, it's also been accompanied by a very long period of stability in our financial system, which remains strong. These are very significant achievements. This is especially so when you think about the very large structural changes that have occurred in the Australian and global economy since the early 1990s and the instability that we've seen in other countries. Now, a country doesn't experience these type of outcomes without some good fortune and, importantly, without strong policy institutions and sensible and consistent policy. In Australia, we've had all these things. Partly through sensible and pragmatic policy, the Australian economy has developed the flexibility to adjust to a changing world. An important element of this flexibility, of course, is our floating exchange rate. Another is our labour market, which has developed the flexibility to adjust to changing circumstances. And a third element is the fact that both monetary and fiscal policy have maintained their ability to adjust to changing circumstances. And all these things have helped us adjust to some large changes in the economy. Australia has also benefited from our openness to the world. We're an open, outward-looking country. Over many decades, our prosperity has been built on our ability to trade in open and competitive markets, our ability to attract capital and ideas from abroad, and the ability to attract talented people to our shores. We've benefited tremendously from an open, inclusive, and rules-based international system. We have as much at stake at the continuation of this system as any other country in the world. Our location on the globe and our mineral and energy resources have both given us a deal of good fortune. In earlier generations, our location was seen as a liability. We were simply too far from the major centres of global growth. Today, though, things have changed and our location on the globe is seen as an asset. We live in the most dynamic region of the global economy, and we've capitalised on this with strong trade and people links with Asia. And over recent times, as a country, we've benefited tremendously from this. The most obvious example is the strong growth in exports of resources, but increasingly, you can also see it in growth of exports of high-quality services, food, and manufactured goods to Asia, and I'm sure this will continue. Naturally enough, after 26 years of economic expansion, people wonder what the future holds for us. This is an issue that comes up a lot in discussions with international investors. So tonight I'd like to take this opportunity to address three related questions that I'm often asked. These questions are, what are the next few years likely to hold for the Australian economy? Second, what are the challenges that face the Australian economy? And third, as other central banks reduce monetary accommodation, won't the RBA have to too? So they're the three questions. First, to the next few years. For a while now, we've been expecting the Australian economy to grow more strongly in 2018 and 19 than it did on average over recent years. And there are a number of reasons for this. First, we're all but through the big decline in mining investment back to more normal levels. There's a very large pipeline of urban infrastructure work to be done. The global economy is experiencing a solid upswing. Commodity prices are rising, boosting incomes, and financial conditions in Australia remain accommodative. All these things are helping. Tomorrow we will be releasing our latest forecast for the economy in the Statement of Monetary Policy. But these forecasts are going to be largely unchanged from the previous set. The RBA's central scenario remains for the Australian economy to grow a bit above 3% on average over the next couple of years. And it's worth pointing out that this outlook has not been affected by the recent volatility in the stock market. Indeed, it's worth keeping in mind that the catalyst for this volatility was a reassessment in financial markets of the implications of strong growth for inflation in the United States. For some time, many investors had been working under the assumptions that the unusually low inflation and the unusually low volatility in asset prices would persist, even with economies growing at above-trend rates at a time of very low unemployment. Then, quite understandably, a reassessment of these assumptions now appears to be taking place against the backdrop of strong global economic conditions. But looking beyond these recent financial events, the data that we've received on the real economy over the summer have been consistent with our assessment that growth in Australia is picking up. Taken together, the recent domestic and global data on the real economy suggests that 2018 is starting off on a more positive footing than has recent years. Particularly noteworthy in Australia has been the strength of the labour market, with employment increasing by 3.25% over the past year. This strong performance has been accompanied by a large number of people joining the workforce, so that the participation rate has now returned to the peak that it reached at the peak of the mining boom a few years ago. It's a remarkable fact. There have been significant increases in the participation rate for both women and for older Australians. And at the same time, the unemployment rate has trended down to around 5.5%, and I expect it will come down further over the next couple of years. Over the summer, business conditions have also been at the highest level since before the financial crisis, and there's also been an improvement in business confidence. Non-mining business investment has been stronger than we'd expected a while ago, and the investment outlook has brightened. One ongoing area of uncertainty, though, is consumer spending. Household incomes are growing only slowly, and the debt levels are high, and I'll return to these two issues in a moment. On the prices front, we continue to experience subdued outcomes, although inflation's higher than it was a year ago. Over 2017, inflation in Australia was a bit under 2% in both headline and underlying terms. And last week's data provided further confirmation of trends that we've been witnessing for some time now. Increased competition in retailing is contributing to price declines for many consumer durables, and those price declines are quite significant. And subdued wage increases are contributing to low rates of inflation in a range of market services, and rent inflation also remains quite low. The immediate outlook is for a continuation of these trends, but for inflation to pick up gradually as the economy and the labour market strengthen. We're expecting inflation, CPI inflation, to be in the range of 2% to 2.5% over the next couple of years, and underlying inflation to be a bit below that. I wanted to touch on a couple of issues that we're paying very close attention to and that could have a significant bearing on the outcomes for both inflation and growth over the next couple of years. The first is wages growth. Not only are most workers experiencing low wage increases, but following the end of the resources boom, some people have moved out of highly paid jobs into jobs with lower rates of pay. The result of these changes is that many Australians are experiencing rather weak growth in both their nominal and their real incomes after for many years they experienced quite strong growth in their real incomes. The effects of low real wage growth on the economy work in different directions. On the one hand, the restrained growth in labour costs is one of the factors that has boosted employment in Australia. But on the other hand, the slow growth in incomes has weighed on people's spending, including by making it harder for people to deal with the level of debt they have. So there are effects here working in opposite directions. But on balance, in the current environment, some pickup in wages growth would be a welcome development. Ideally, this would be on the back of stronger growth in productivity. But even if productivity growth were to be around the average of recent years, a faster rate of increase in wages should be possible. Indeed, a lift in wages growth is likely to be necessary for inflation to average around the midpoint of our 2-3% medium-term target range. Stronger growth in real wages would also boost household incomes and create a stronger sense of shared prosperity in our community. Our central scenario is for this pickup in wages growth to occur as the economy strengthens, but to do so only gradually. Through our liaison with business at the moment, we hear some reports of wage pressures emerging in pockets where labour markets are tight, particularly here in Sydney. We expect that over time we will hear more of such reports. After all, the laws of supply and demand in the labour market still work. I've spoken previously about the factors affecting wages, and many of those factors have a global origin. Globalisation and advances in technology have increased competition, and greater competition means less pricing power. And given the strength and the pervasiveness of these factors, I think it's unlikely that they're going to disappear quickly, so the pickup in wages growth that we're expecting is likely to be quite gradual. A second factor shaping the outlook is the level of household debt. Indeed, the high level of household debt in Australia is remarked upon by international investors almost as often as the run of 26 years of uninterrupted growth. A while back, we had become quite concerned about some of the trends in household borrowing, including very fast growth in lending to investors and the very high share of loans being made that did not require regular repayment of principal, interest-only loans. Our concern wasn't that these developments in household balance sheets posed a risk to the stability of our banking system, which is strong, it's well capitalised and highly liquid. Rather, it was more that these developments posed a broader macro stability risk. That is, the day might come when faced with bad economic news, households feel that they had borrowed too much and they respond to that by cutting back their spending sharply, damaging the macro economy. So it was a macro stability risk, really not a classic financial stability risk. We've worked closely with APRA, including through the Council of Financial Regulators, to address these issues. This work, together with other steps that have taken by APRA, have helped improve the quality of bank lending in Australia. In the housing market, there have also been some recent changes. National measures of housing prices are up by only around 3% over the past year, and that's a marked change from the situation when we held this dinner a year ago. The change is most pronounced here in Sydney, where prices are no longer rising, and conditions have also cooled a bit in Melbourne. These changes in the housing market have reduced the incentive for people to borrow at very low interest rates to invest in an asset whose price is rising quickly. That's a positive thing. On balance, then, from a macro stability perspective, the situation looks less risky than it was a while ago. We do, however, continue to watch household balance sheets very carefully because there are obvious risks there. So that's the factors that are likely to shape the next couple of years. I now like to turn to the second issue that I raised at the outset, and that is the challenges facing the Australian economy. When I spoke at this dinner this time last year, I talked about four challenges. The first, the need to reinvigorate productivity growth. The second, finding ways of capitalising on the opportunities we have in Asia. Third, providing the infrastructure needed for a growing population and to support productivity. And fourth, making sure that our public finances were on the right track and that our tax system was internationally competitive. By no means is this a complete list. At a minimum, you could add the issues that I've just spoken about, wages growth and the high levels of debt. But I think it remains a reasonable list, and I thought it useful to offer an update. Improving our productivity remains the key to further improvements in our living standards, stating the obvious. Average growth in labour productivity has been a bit higher since the peak of the mining investment boom than it was in the preceding few years, although capital deepening has been an important part of that story. Late last year, the Productivity Commission provided some guidance about how we might lift our productivity growth going forward. It released the first of its 5 yearly reports, the Shifting the Dial report. This report is another example of an Australian policy institution tackling important issues through serious and systematic analysis. Really, the central theme of that report is the importance of services and of cities. Most Australians now work in the services sector, and most of us live in cities. So how we deliver those services and how our cities function really will have a major influence on how our living standards evolve over the next generation. So this is a really important area, and it's another area that will benefit from a strong innovation mindset. On building our links with Asia, we continue to see progress. The new trade agreements are opening up new opportunities for Australian business in the region, and the share of Australian exports going to Asia continues to rise. Last year, the value of Australia's merchandise exports increased by more than 15% to each of China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, and the Philippines. Fast growth to all those countries. Exports of resources have been an important part of this, but it's broader than that, with strong growth in exports of services. And person-to-person links with Asia also continue to deepen. I think this is important, with half of all international investors to Australia last year coming from Asia. I'm sure that trend will continue. On infrastructure, the story is a positive one too. Increased public spending on infrastructure in our largest cities is currently providing a boost to our economy. It's increasing demand, and it's also building the productive capacity that we need for the future. With our population continuing to grow at a relatively fast rate for a developed economy, it's around 1.5% a year, this is an area for us to continue to focus on. As we do this, we need to pay very close attention to the governance of decisions around project selection, the control of construction costs, the way we price the use of the infrastructure, and the allocation of risk between the public and the private sectors. Good governance in these areas is important to support sound decision-making, but it's also important to retain public trust and confidence in government spending and borrowing decisions in these areas. And finally, on the fiscal side, the latest estimates are that things are on track to meet the Australian government's projection of returning the budget to balance in 2021. Australia's record of careful management of public finances meant when the financial crisis hit, fiscal policy was able to play a constructive, stabilising role for the overall economy. Ensuring that our public finances are on a sustainable footing is important to ensuring that we have similar flexibility in the future. The issue of how the tax system affects the competitiveness of Australia as a destination for investment is one of ongoing political debate. There have been some cuts in company tax, and the Parliament is considering further changes. I'd now like to turn to the final question that I'm asked often, and that is, as other central banks raise their interest rates, won't the RBA have to too? It's understandable why people ask this question. Over time, there is a common element to movement in interest rates around the world. The level of interest rates in all countries is influenced by the movement in the global real interest rate. During the financial crisis, this neutral rate fell, and this had an important influence on the setting of interest rates everywhere, including here in Australia. If we had not lowered our interest rates as global rates fell, the Australian economy would not have grown at the rate that it did, and inflation would have been lower than it turned out to be. But the fact that there is a common element in interest rates does not mean that interest rates need to move in lockstep with one another. Countries with a floating exchange rate like Australia still retain considerable flexibility to set interest rates based on their own domestic considerations. We did not lower our interest rates to the extraordinarily low levels seen elsewhere after the financial crisis. Our circumstances were different. We didn't have a meltdown in our financial system, and we experienced a very large cycle in commodity prices and mining investment. Just as we did not move in lockstep on the way down, we don't need to do that in the other direction. It's clearly understandable why some other central banks are starting to raise interest rates. They lowered their rates by more than us, and the unemployment in a number of countries is now below conventional estimates of full employment, and this is at a time that when further above-trend growth is expected. Again, our circumstances are a little different. We are still some way from what could be considered full employment, and our central forecast for inflation is for it to remain below the midpoint of the medium-term target range for the next couple of years. We do, though, expect to make further progress in reducing unemployment and having inflation return to the midpoint of the target range. If we do make that progress, at some point it will be appropriate for interest rates in Australia to move up as well. So given recent developments here and overseas, it is likely that the next movement in interest rates in Australia will be up, not down. If this is how things play out, the likely timing will depend upon the extent and pace of the progress that we make. As I've discussed, while we do expect steady progress, that progress is likely to be only gradual. Given this, the Reserve Bank Board does not see a strong case for a near-term adjustment to monetary policy and will, of course, keep that judgment under review at future meetings. So they're the three questions that I get asked frequently. I hope that's helpful in answering them. I hope these remarks have given you some insight into the Australian economy and some of the opportunities and challenges we face. Thank you for your attendance, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Governor. As the Governor mentioned, it's open for questions. Perhaps in the usual way, if you could introduce yourself and your organisation before answering the question. We'll start with the room and then we'll move to media after that. So I'm happy to direct questions to the Governor.
Yeah. That show of virtual investments, Governor. Thank you for your remarks, as always. We've lived in a world of also extraordinarily low interest rates for now a decade. US Fed's hit their inflation target in four individual months since the end of 2008. The ECB, the Bank of Japan, haven't hit it ever since then. Given your comments about globalisation and that continuing trend and accelerating technology, do you now think that sub 2% core inflation in major economies is the norm?
I expect inflation to pick up overseas, but I expect it to do only gradually. Now, the central issue here is really the behaviour of the labour market. Wage growth has been surprisingly weak in countries with very low unemployment rates. If you think about the United States, the UK, Germany, Japan, they've got very, very low unemployment rates, in some cases the lowest unemployment rates in four decades. Yet wages are still kind of below average. At some point, I expect those tight labour markets will lead to stronger wage growth and inflation will pick up. And we saw a hint of that on Friday in the US, and people then reassess the outlook of inflation. But it's a gradual process because these forces acting on the labour market are so strong. And the Japanese economy is growing strongly. Partly that's on the back of the easy monetary policy, but it shouldn't always be on the back of the easy monetary policy, and the same case you could make in some of the European economies. So over time, I expect this will correct. But if we stay in a world of multi-decade low unemployment rates at very low interest rates and the wages don't pick up, that would be very strange. But kind of answer to Matt's question, I don't think we're going to stay there, but it's going to be a gradual normalisation. I don't see this kind of turning around quickly. But I think it will gradually normalise, and we need to be prepared for that. And that will mean higher global interest rates. It'll mean, at a time, higher interest rates here in Australia as well. More volatility. That period that we had really the second half of last year, was extraordinarily low volatility that lasted for 6 months. And people seem to start to think this was normal. We just have low inflation, low unemployment, low volatility. It was kind of the reverse of the 1970s, wasn't it, where we had high unemployment and high inflation. And it was kind of a belief that we could kind of live in this world forever. I was sceptical about that, and I think there'll be a normalisation, but you know, it's going to take time.
Other questions?
I think the view is more interesting.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Hi, Susui Kim from Canada Pension Plan Investment Board. As an investor, we oftentimes ask about what are the downside risks, what keeps you up at night over time. What I want to ask is something the opposite. Where do you see potential surprise to the upside in Australian economy?
In the short term, the stronger global growth, it's synchronized. We're not just having stronger growth in one or two countries, it's synchronized across the world. So it's quite possible that we could see a stronger global upswing, and that will be good for commodity prices, that will be good for Australian income growth. Businesses will feel better. They haven't been investing very much for a long period of time outside the resources sector. So this lifting global conditions, higher commodity prices, stronger Australian confidence, see more progress here on reducing unemployment and getting inflation back to target. So I think that's quite possible. The infrastructure spending is an important part of the Australian growth story. The New South Wales and Victorian government have significant plans there, and that story could broaden out across other states as well, which would be a positive development. So there's some of the things that, the links we have with Asia, you know, we have tremendous opportunities there, and we've really explored them very well in the resources side, but I hear more and more stories of exploiting them on the services side of the economy, and as I said in my remarks, kind of in agriculture and services and high-tech manufacturing. So I see tremendous opportunities there. So there's a lot of very good things here. You know, I think Australian business is kind of starting to see the good things more. For really, since the financial crisis and the mining investment boom, businesses outside the resources sector kind of were feeling a bit glum. There was kind of this lack of animal spirits. And I detect those spirits are just starting to come back. They're not here fully, but they're starting to come back, and there's good reason for them to come back.
Other questions, including from representatives of the media? Yes, right down the back.
Governor Lowe, Carrington Clark from the ABC. Can I just ask the question about the return to surplus? You've noted the importance of getting back by 2021. What would corporate tax cuts that imperil that potential surplus do to confidence, and how would that impact the economy?
I'm assuming if there were further changes in the tax system, it wouldn't put us off track on return to surplus. I think this is why this is kind of there are two perspectives, I think, why this is important. First of all is insurance. I'm a conservative central banker, so I like insurance. And I saw kind of the strong record of Australia's on fiscal policy meant that when the financial crisis hit in the downturn, you know, we'd had the insurance through good fiscal policy, and we were able to kind of cash in the insurance policy and spend, and that supported the economy. But you can only have that type of insurance if you pay the premiums. And the premiums is getting kind of the budget in decent shape in good times, and now we're kind of returning to good times. So I think that's important. So insurance valuable, you have to pay for it, and you pay for it by having a balance in good times. And my other perspective on this is really comes from the father of three children, the intergenerational issue, the importance of kind of meeting current expenditure from current revenue with the exception of capital accumulation. There are important issues. On corporate tax, I think there is international tax competition going on. Some people might think that's a good thing. Other people think it's kind of regrettable, particularly if you worry about balancing the budget. But it is going on, and we need to pay attention to that. The Parliament will have to work out how to deal with it. And I think the other observation I make here is tax is not the only thing that influences investment decisions. I look around the room here. There are a lot of investors here. I hope you're not here just because of Australia's tax rate. You're here because a lot of other fantastic things in this country. So, you know, there's a lot of focus on tax, and I can understand why that is, but you're all here because of the fantastic opportunities our country offers. And so we've got to kind of think about the whole mix of things that influence the investment climate, not just the tax system.
Can I just ask a follow-up on the corporate tax question? The Japanese government is looking at a corporate tax cut linked to wages, just linking two of your themes tonight, where they'll be giving corporate tax cuts based on those companies that give aggressive wage hikes. Do you think there's any academic merit to that?
I haven't thought about whether there's academic merit to it. It seems overly complicated and too many connections. These things are so hard to do. I can see kind of significant implementation problems with that. But the Japanese government is responding to the same pressure as many others are. There's international tax competition going on. As I said, you could think that's good or bad, and they're part of this as well. And the lack of wage growth has been a major issue in Japan. And I talk to the governor of the Bank of Japan and other officials in Japan and say, well, why aren't wages rising there? You know, we've got very strong, tight labour markets. And part of the answer is, well, faced with these tight labour markets, firms are finding efficiencies. You know, and another part of the story, is, rather than hiring new workers, another part of the story is, well, and I hear this a lot in Sydney as well, when I ask business leaders why they're not paying more wages, they say, yes, well, it'd be good if other people paid higher wages. But, of course, you've got to understand it's very competitive in my industry. So I can't possibly pay higher wages, but it'd be great if everyone else did, because there'd be more income for the community. So, you know, the Japanese authorities are kind of grappling with the same thing. And tight labour markets leads to more innovation, which keeps downward pressure on costs. And this very strong competitive environment globally means no one kind of, well, people kind of take a lot of pushing to push up wages. So whether that can be linked to the corporate tax system, it seems like a kind of, you know, it might work in Japan, but there's a level of over-engineering here.
I have time for, say, one more. I think there's one down the back.
Governor Lowe, Michael Heath from Bloomberg. Just picking up on what you were saying on retail competition and disinflation there, obviously Amazon came late last year. So do you expect retail disinflation will persist, or are we sort of through that process, or is it ongoing? What's your view there, or your expectation?
I find it hard to answer that. It's been very persistent, and I expect it will persist for quite some time. We've seen it in food retailing. We had some foreign supermarkets come in and push down the price of food. If you look at the price index for basically supermarket food, it hasn't moved anywhere for 5 or 6 years. That's really competition, which is actually good for consumers. The retailers don't like it, but it's good for consumers. And now clothing and footwear prices, and last year they're down 3%, and furniture prices are now down 3%. You're getting kind of retailers coming in to spaces where they hadn't really been, and they're shaking up the Australian industry. They're finding forcing the Australian retailers to come up with efficiency savings. So this process, I think, has further run. It's hard to know exactly how far, but I think it's got a way to go. And this is one of the reasons why we think kind of the pickup in inflation here is only going to be gradual. This kind of labour market recovery is kind of the pickup in wages is gradual, and this persistent deflation coming from increased competition in retailing is an ongoing story.
Governor, we have one more. So where are we?
Governor Joanna Mather from the Australian Financial Review. Do you anticipate any further action on the macroprudential controls on housing investment, or is the job there done, do you think?
Well, I don't think we need any further controls at the moment. The limit on interest-only loans, I thought that was a very sensible thing to do. And when I kind of talk to my overseas peers and say, well, more than 40% of the new loans in the country were being made to borrowers who didn't have to make a single dollar of principal repayment on a regular basis. They say, well, how? Why would you allow that? I understand why that takes place in Australia, but it didn't feel right to me. It felt like it was kind of building up risk in the system. And so that was addressed, and I would hope something would be, there would be a permanent element of that. The growth in investor lending was the other part of it. The macroprudential restrictions, and growth in investor lending has slowed a lot. You know, it's low single digits now. So at some point there might be an opportunity to look at that, and I'll see how that could evolve into something else. But we'll have to look at that over the coming months. So I don't see the need for further restrictions at the moment. I think the restrictions that we put in place have served their purpose. The housing market looks more stable, borrowing patterns look more sensible, and the things that Wayne Byers and his colleagues have done have strengthened lending standards in the system. So, as I said in my prepared remarks, things look less risky. there than I have for some time on the borrowing and housing front. I hope that continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor.